This podcast is sponsored in part by Intesa Communications Group, a women-owned PR and government relations firm that helps you communicate and advocate with confidence. Intesa colleagues are deeply ingrained in the issues and communities you care about most. From universities and nonprofits to corporate developers, theme parks, and tech titans, Intesa helps thoughtful leaders from all sectors shape San Diego for the better. Learn more at IntesaCom.com. This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I am Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego, and I'm joined in studio after many, many, many months since Tom Hanks Day 2020 by Andrew Keats, assistant editor. Hello, Andy.
My wife was newly pregnant last time we were in here, and I have a nine-month-old child now.
Wow. That's one way to measure it. Sarah and Sarah Libby, our managing editor. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
That's right. We are in the Voice of San Diego studio. Coming up on the show this week, another local defector from the Republican Party, former San Diego mayor Jerry Sanders, told the New York Times he renounced his party after the January 6th storming of the Capitol. We'll talk about the state of the local Republican Party and what it means to actually vote Republican now. What are we going for there if you do it? Homelessness in San Diego is officially, quote, near a crisis level. That, of course, has been the case as long as we've been here. We've been calling it a crisis for a while, but new reporting lays out just how big the problem really is and how much money local leaders are ready to throw at it. Andy's back this week, so we're going to add some context to the local sports arena, San Diego special situation. Something is definitely still going to happen there, and we'll try to explain why. And finally, Measure B, which was passed last year, says a new commission on police practices is going to have more power and money than the previous oversight group. It's at a pivotal point, though, now, as the official ordinance for it is being written. We'll talk about what's going on there and what it means. Stay with us. But before we get going, we just want to say thanks to everyone who gave last week during our fundraising campaign. It means a lot to us because we rely on listeners and supporters and readers to make this all happen. If you missed it or didn't get around to it, we still accept donations, turns out. And it's especially important right now. It's the last few days of our fiscal year. If you become a member at $3 a month, that gets you access to the Politics Report and other cool stuff. And you can do that now at vosd.org/give. So much. We are back in the studio together. Andy and I did not find anything to fight about, though, so it's not a truly authentic pre-podcast experience right now. But we are back. We're talking. We're sharing aerosols.
Yeah, that's a way to put it.
Not the way I would prefer putting it, but it is true.
It's a way.
You guys remember we recorded here with a couple of people, got former Councilman Mark Kersey, Eva Posner here, the day that we found out that the virus was kind of a big deal, shutting down the NBA.
Seared into my brain.
It's been weird to go back to different situations. So we went out for Father's Day dinner. And by the way, restaurants are really busy. If you have an important dinner, consider figuring out reservations in advance. Can't just walk up to your favorite place. Apparently, it turns out.
Men. But, go on.
Is that something your species knew about?
Let me tell you, Mother's Day reservations were locked in.
Well, I did notice one thing, though. So remember when they raised the minimum wage in California and in San Diego and these restaurants started putting surcharges on their bills? I know Sarah remembers that.
Yes.
Well, there was a surcharge on our bill on Father's Day, and it was called it was a 4% surcharge. and it was called the Pandemic Recovery Surcharge. And I thought that was a new twist.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah.
It's an interesting one because the minimum wage surcharge, which, depending on how it's structured, can be illegal. And even if it's structured legally, is something that a lot of people don't like. But it at least has a direct connection. They're saying our costs are up because of this very specific thing, and that's the amount that we've decided to charge you for it. It is not at all clear to me what a pandemic recovery surcharge is for, other than like we have less money than we'd like.
Exactly.
And here is a charge so that you'll give us more of yours.
No, I think
and
you
then we'd have
I think
it.
You get it.
Yeah. Well, it was so the deal with it when those minimum wage things passed and they started putting on the bills like government mandated fee or whatever, right? Or so the city attorney was like, "Nah."
Yeah.
Like,
there's two components of it. So one is it has to be visible on your menu when you're ordering.
Yeah,
you
this
can't
is a
just
fee you'll pay. Yeah.
Happen, which it sounds like happened to you, which is like surprise on your bill. There's an extra 4%.
The prices on the menu aren't real.
Yeah.
Right. And then there's like the phrasing itself. They can't make it sound like they are being mandated by the government to charge you this.
Right. Because they have an alternative, which is to raise their prices.
Yes. Which is what you should all do, cowards.
So I have a plea out for you all in the podcast listener audience. If you go to a restaurant and you get one of these surcharges, I'd like to send a picture in to scott@voiceofsandiego.org. That's scott@voiceofsandiego.org.
Make sure the credit card numbers are visible. And if it doesn't have it, write the CVC code as well.
That's not true. He's trolling. All I want to see is what they call the surcharge. And we'll do a little collection on that. Is it pandemic recovery surcharge? Is it government mandates we're dealing with surcharge?
I've seen a lot that are kind of flowery language about like, we need to provide healthcare and nice things for our employees. And aren't those things great? They sure cost a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
Something like that.
So we'd like to see that. I don't want to put this particular restaurant on blast because they saved Father's Day.
Their food tasted good and
delicious.
You liked it.
But we'll collect and maybe get some responses from the restaurateurs.
I think they're a lot more prevalent than people realize. So just take a look. No matter what it says, like they're probably on your bill and you might not know it.
So the New York Times wanted to do one of its "Here's What's Happening" stories in the country. And it was like the Republicans aren't really competing in some of these cities. And Sarah, you clicked on it. You're like, maybe they'll mention San Diego.
I actually did a control F for San Diego, thinking like, you know, they'll throw that in somewhere down. No, it was the lead.
It was
the top. It was the heart of the story.
Which was that?
It was like my computer was like owning me a little bit.
They're
it's paragraph one. Thanks for checking.
Yeah, maybe start reading this.
Maybe
then.
Read it.
Yeah. It was, and the news was that former mayor Jerry Sanders left the Republican Party. He's now the head of the San Diego Regional Chamber of Commerce, has been since he left the mayor's office, and that's part of a trend.
Yeah, they're a little bit casual about it.
Yeah.
said that he renounced his party affiliation the day after the attack on the Capitol. They didn't say specifically whether that means he switched parties officially, what he might have switched to or anything like that. But that was kind of news to all of us, I think.
Yeah. Yep. Just to remind everybody, Jerry Sanders, of course, was a Republican who ran for mayor in 2005 and won against Democratic candidate Donna Fry. He was big in the idea of like reforming pensions, of like trying to farm out city services to people who would do it cheaper, and, you know, in general, controlling spending or such. It was, you know, he wasn't ever a firebrand. There was that weird moment, I think it was 2008 or something, when he came out against Proposition 8, the anti-gay marriage initiative. And there was a very tearful sort of national press conference, that, or national news about the press conference that he held when he explained why he switched and changed his mind on that. But, you know, he was a Republican. He was kind of a classic Southern California Republican, you know, support business, limit regulation, control government spending. And for him to leave, it was just yet another indication of people who are leaving, as we've talked about. Summer Steffen, district attorney, she left the party. Now she's going to run for re-election as an independent. So unlike a lot of these folks, she's still in the game. Mark Kersey was a councilman, left, became an independent. Brian Mainshine, he's also still in the game as an assemblyman. He was Republican, but he switched all the way to another party. So he's still aligned with the party. Nathan Fletcher, of course, kind of the OG in this, back in 2012 when he was running for mayor. Lori Zaff, former city councilwoman, she left after she lost her reelection for city council in the coastal district of San Diego. Bill Baber, he's a councilman in La Mesa. He left the party. Again, the list, there's a lot of people who have left the party. And I think the New York Times point was like, are they even trying?
There was an interesting part of the story to me, which was that there was a Republican mayor in between the one that they wrote about,
yeah,
that didn't make it into the story.
Yeah. Who's still Republican.
It was running for governor right now.
Yeah.
So there was another San Diego Republican in the story who I also thought was kind of illustrative of where things are at, and that's Daryl Issa. And they actually got it wrong and said that he lost re-election in his district and then came back after switching districts to the one formerly represented by Duncan Hunter. He, of course, actually just decided not to run for re-election. He saw the writing on the wall.
Well, he retired.
Of course.
Yeah, it wasn't because of that. He was just going to take it easy.
Yeah.
But
in fact, you got quite a bit of criticism from a few different trolls for.
Yeah, I said he's obviously daring because he knows he's going to lose. And they're like, how dare you? Like, he's just retiring.
A man says he's retiring. Who are you to question his motives?
And to be clear, Daryl Issa has always been a firebrand. He's always been, you know, very, very conservative. But I don't know if you guys remember the months leading up to his decision to retire, but when it was still thought that he was going to be running for re-election, defending his seat in a very different seat, it was an endless stream of just community. He did a lot of stints like guest barista-ing at Starbucks.
So that's the one I'm thinking of. Right. That's the one I'm thinking just of because like, he's got that grin.
Oh yeah.
Where he's holding out the cup of coffee, I'm part of the community.
I'm just a man in the community and like forget partisan politics. I'm just like a guy at the Oceanside Starbucks handing out drinks. And now, you know, he's in like one of the only just solidly very, very red districts. And he sent out a press release this morning about how the biggest threat from big tech is censorship of conservatives and just like very red meat, very solidly to the right. And I think that gives you a clear picture of like, instead of fighting out like a policy battle about like why he deserves to keep his seat in a district that has people who think differently, he just, screw this. I'm going to go to the district and keep being me.
No, there's more to that. Remember in the early, 2005, 2010, he would go on Bill Maher all the time. Yeah. Remember he was like really seen trying to.
He was a conservative guy, but he would play to the idea of moderation just by going on Bill Maher.
Technocratic, right? Progressivism kind of things that he would try to embrace. And now he's like, whatever, we're just going to take that team. So fascinating. So I guess we were just left wondering, like, what is the direction of the local Republican Party? Are they going to try?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that they don't seem to be doing at all right now. I mean, say what you will about them 10 years ago, they had a theory about how best to run cities. It maybe hasn't aged especially well, and the legacy of some of their biggest measures has sort of fallen apart since then, but between pension reform and union labor reform and managed competition, they were sort of leading with reform initiatives that were pushing cities to the right. Now it's like, if anything, it's like, how can we turn these national culture war issues into city issues? How can we jam these hot button topics into something that has something or other to do with the governance of a city? But there's no actual care for governing a city. There doesn't seem to be, at least.
Yeah, I mean, look at the local Republican Party. Tony Krivorek stepped aside. He's no longer visible on like Twitter. He's out. The new chief of the Republican Party in San Diego, Paula Witzel, refuses to talk to the media, has only chosen like more insular routes. And so you're kind of wondering, is that infrastructure even trying? There is one candidate. So we have one Republican left on the San Diego City Council, Chris Cate. He is now termed out. He's a year away from the primary to replace him. And there's a lot of people running. There is one Republican running. And we tried to like get a sense of like what she might be kind of pitching, right? Like to, you know, what are they pitching? What's the Republican Party pitching right now? So her name is Jocelyn Lomahan. She's a realtor in that Mira Mesa area and said running for District 6. And here was her initial sort of advertisement.
Just like the example my parents set for me. But today, our community's dreams are at risk. Our local small businesses have been hit hard by the pandemic. Our infrastructure needs continuing repairs. Our housing is too expensive and in short supply. As your council member, I'll fight for our communities, not someone else's agenda. We deserve a leader who will listen to our community and get things done. I'm running for council.
Like infrastructure, housing, and businesses. I mean, that's not really a distinct approach from what any kind of generic neoliberal Democrat might say too. Like, we need good infrastructure, we need to support businesses and these things. So I guess I don't know what they're going for right now.
Yeah, I mean, I would also point to the fact that Kevin Faulkner is running for governor, and it's not like his record as mayor features prominently in his pitch to become governor. Like, he actually did genuinely do a lot on housing development in the city, but it's not like he's talking about that. It's not like he holds that up as an alternative view from what you see out of Sacramento otherwise.
Yeah, I think to the extent that he's touting pieces of his record, it's probably on homelessness. We've pointed out the ways in which that might be a little disingenuous, but I think his pitch boils down to, here is a thing Gavin Newsom did badly, and I would not do that.
Well, let's move on. Let's talk about that. So that's the next topic we wanted to get into, homelessness. There is a serious crisis here happening and sort of growing. But when you listen to what Kevin Faulkner said, he's like, I reduced homelessness in San Diego. I can do that here. And if you or do that throughout the state. And if you asked him, I think if you asked him and his consultants to try to really boil down his plan, the sort of Faulkner doctrine on homelessness, they would say, well, you build shelters. And then you clean the streets. You say you have to go to the shelters, you get off. But as you pointed out, Andy, when he was here running that kind of program, he never described it like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, you could squint and see a strategy along those lines there, but it was never pitched in those terms. He never went up at the state of the city and said, let me tell you what we're going to do to get our streets cleared of homelessness. We're going to build these shelters, and then law enforcement is going to be our primary means of outreach, and it'll become clear that people don't have an option to avoid these shelters. It just wasn't pitched that way at all. So I don't, if that was the approach, they certainly were never comfortable saying that's the approach.
Well, we've talked about this a little bit over the last couple of weeks, but Lisa Alverstadt on her staff did a piece really driving home just how much homelessness has spiked, at least visible homelessness in the city of San Diego. And these numbers are kind of incredible. So there was a 22% spike in the homeless population downtown from April to May alone, nearly 62% increase in the outskirts of downtown. So I guess that would include like Barrio Logan and these areas. Here was the data point that really stuck out for me. The Downtown Partnership counted 1,157 homeless San Diegans in the downtown area in their latest count for this month that came out. But they also counted 389 tents during that monthly tally. So they go around, they look at how many tents are, they try to multiply it by how many people they assume are in them. Now, 389 tents, that was 170 in April. So in 2 months, More than double the number of tents have popped up in San Diego's downtown in that period. Police data show a 21% increase in dispatch calls to respond to people who are thought to be in crisis. And then residents and business leaders are talking about more open drug use, more erratic behavior. And they said in there, the quote was that's nearing a crisis. I mean, there's no way to describe this as anything but a crisis, has been for quite some time. I mean, we had a show like 6 months ago about that, after that accident where, you know, the man careened his car into an encampment and caused so much death and horrific scene there. So, you know, when has it not been a crisis?
No, I mean, it's a crisis. I mean, and certainly that tent number sticks out, but the first two numbers that you mentioned are really dramatic as well. A 62% increase in downtown outskirts. That's huge. Almost a 25% spike just in a single month.
Yeah.
It is now reached this level of a sort of chronic condition that you still always describe in dramatic terms, but at a certain point you have to just become like cynical that anything's ever going to change. I mean, we've been talking about it in these same terms for at least 10 years since I've been here. It's been discussed this way. This crisis, you know, the situation has gotten better or worse at the margins in short periods, but there's never been a time that anybody seemed to feel very confident that things were improving in homelessness.
What year was it when we did the day where all media covered homelessness?
2016, like, I think.
Yeah.
Like summer 2016, which only happens if there's collective buy-in among all of the media outlets that this is really bad. Mm-hmm. Right? That was like 5 years ago.
Yeah. Well, Mayor Todd Gloria and County Supervisor Nathan Fletcher, you know, sort of anticipating, I think, or hearing from Lisa all these questions she had about these numbers, they did launch on Friday a press release where they kind of announced their plan, but it wasn't clear to me what the plan was. To the extent I understood the Faulkner plan of like build tents that they have to go to and then sweep the streets, you can disagree with it or whatever, but it seemed like a clear sort of approach. Again, he never wanted to articulate it. Mm-hmm. And so it's funny for him to say, I had a plan, but never really articulated it on the state stage as well. But that said, there was a kind of framing to that. But they've only kind of announced a lot of priorities. They're going to send out more outreach teams, and they're going to spend nearly $100 million more than the increased spending that's already occurred on this problem. Now, what stuck out for me, that $100 million, so if you do the math, there's 8,000 homeless people in San Diego region. $100 million is like $12,500 per person out there. Now, I know it's not a static population. It grows and changes. There's like a leak in a dam kind of, but still, there's a lot of money per person that could almost fund a big subsidy for their housing. So what did we get a clear idea of what the plan is for all of that?
I haven't heard a clear plan. Maybe Sarah has. What I fear is that it becomes hard not just to track spending, but this new $100 million, that it ends up just being new ingredients that go into the soup of all of the different efforts that we're put into. And we're never able to come back and say, hey, you said on X day that you were doing $100 million in new spending, new programs. How is that effort going?
And where's that? Where's that delta from where it was?
It'll be like, well, here's all the things we do in homelessness. And it's like, okay, so it's just part of everything now, which, you know, it may be the best way to provide services, but it is difficult to sort of line up any sort of results based on this announcement that was intended to head off concerns about the worsening situation.
And there's always been this tension, right, of we need more permanent homes to put people in, to provide for people. Those things, of course, take a lot of time and a lot of money. And what do you do in the meantime? Do you crack down really, you know, strongly, or do you have some sort of more compassionate approach where you allow it? You know, Todd Gloria mentioned it might be more visible while we wait for more permanent solutions. Well, those permanent solutions take a really long time. So, like, how long are we talking?
And at that growth, I mean, if it's doubling in 2 months, like, you're starting to talk about, like, actual Skid Row, you know, communities being built and established. And obviously, those aren't easy to adapt or change. So I think, you know, there's going to be some big debates over the next few months. There's a push among some downtown insiders to try to create a safe camping area where, you know, these tents could be set up. But again, part of what's happening is like clearly these tent encampments are more attractive in ways than going to these shelters. And I can see that. I mean, you know, if you can find a place to go to the bathroom or whatever, why wouldn't you want that kind of situation as compared to some of these shelter type environments? I mean, I'm not saying either is a great option, but you can see that to compete with that as a solution, there's going to have to be some really different thinking.
Yeah, I think Lisa Story articulated a little bit that they're trying to open more so-called like low barrier shelters where there are fewer kind of rules and restrictions. And that brings up like the fact that there are so many rules and restrictions on the existing shelters and like why aren't they all this way if that's the way to encourage people to them.
But then you think about like a provider, like does a provider want to be managing a shelter where people are doing
coming and going at all hours
or opioids or otherwise like
animals
doing
in and out.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot that goes into that. It's a massive problem and I don't envy anybody trying to deal with it, but it's spiking and it's getting to a level that obviously people are really concerned about. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
This podcast is sponsored in part by Intesa Communications Group, a women-owned PR and government relations firm that helps you communicate and advocate with confidence. Intesa colleagues are deeply ingrained in the issues and communities you care about most. From universities and nonprofits to corporate developers, theme parks, and tech titans, Intesa helps thoughtful leaders from all sectors shape San Diego for the better. Learn more at intesacom.com.
Well, last week, Andy got the thrill of hearing us talk about how we missed him on the show, and we were talking about a topic that he could add value to. And I feel like stupid about doing that now because he got so much joy out of it.
I mean, did we do that? I thought what happened is we explained it just fine and it went great.
It's true. It's true. We're kind of underestimating ourselves, really, right?
Yeah. I think that's the lesson here.
We should apologize to ourselves.
We did great.
Yeah.
And it was fine.
Yeah, that's true. But he is here now.
He's
maybe he
also
has
here, yeah.
some value to add. About what's happened at the Sports Arena site. So, to be clear, I think the top thing to understand about the Sports Arena area is that whole land, that whole area is owned by the city of San Diego. It's city land. Do we know why? Was it like old, like Spanish land or something?
Yeah. Yes, that's what it was.
I don't know the answer to that.
I should find out.
It was old Spanish land.
Well, anyway, so that whole, and then not just the sports arena and the swap meet parking lot, but.
What a crazy question that would be to ask city staff. Like, I understand that this is city owned land. What I need to know is why. Why do you own this?
Well, there's some that, like, the.
Is it old Spanish land?
Which. The land is owned by the city, including the land under, like, Phil's Barbecue and Dixieland Lumber. And all of those leases, or most of them, are expired.
Strategically.
Yes, they set
been
that
designed
in
to expire simultaneously to make way for this redevelopment. Yes.
And what the previous mayor had done, and by the way, it's amazing that he's still stumbling on real estate deals, even though he's been gone for several months now.
Hats off.
Yeah, very impressive.
It turns out trying to rush through one final real estate deal
right.
to prove that the real estate deal that was a scandal at the time was not part of a trend is only good so far as you don't develop a new scandal around the one that you're rushing through at the end, which maybe they missed on here.
Yeah. Well, just
I mean, I don't know if you call this a scandal, but certainly a A whiff. It's a good one.
I think a stumble is good.
Stumble.
A little bit of a stumble. So now, but that's probably what we want to explain. So as we talked about last week, now what the state has said is that for this sort of land to be redeveloped, you have to first say, hey, other governments, do you want it? And you have to say, hey, affordable housing developers, do you want it? Mm-hmm. And that's the step that the former mayor hadn't taken. And that's the step that the state says they should have taken. And that's the step that now the mayor, current mayor, Todd Gloria, has said they must take. Thus, they need to get rid of the deal that they made with a developer who was going to propose what he or she would do to that land. So now we're basically starting from zero. But I think it's important, Andy, to drive home that both this doesn't change the vote that was made to change the entire height limit for the entire area of the Midway District, going from Old Town all the way to the Sports Arena area. That is still a thing. That height limit is gone.
Yeah.
And the second issue is those leases are still expired. They need to be renewed. Something new needs to happen in that area, and that will still go forward.
Yeah, everything that was in place that made the city want to do this is still have this city-owned land that is unproductive, basically, that they think could be more productive, that they think could be part of providing housing that we need. Allowing a private developer to build that housing could provide enough profit that they would agree to renovate or build us a new stadium or a new arena there. All of those things are still in place. And so, yeah, it's a stumble, but there's no reason that they're just going to allow the land to lay fallow.
None of the physics of the situation changed, except that this preliminary deal the city had with this one developer is off the table, and they're going to have to reopen that.
Right. And, you know, they could, after they reopen it, assuming that all the public agencies decide to pass on it, that they don't say, oh, we would like to take over that land, and assuming that affordable housing developers don't jump on it, which they might, but it's a lot of land, and it would be pretty quick. So, but assuming both of those things that don't happen, this other developer could come back with their same proposal.
And it might even be more attractive to other developers because, unlike before, the people bidding on the property know that the height limit has been upped or changed and actually taken away. And so they can build more things there. They might want to bid on it. In fact, Brookfield helped that happen. And so thanks for paving that street. We can now drive on it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And yeah, so I mean, they only got two bids last time around, but it was the situation where you were bidding on something on the bet that if Measure E passed, you would be able to build at these elevated heights. But, you know, there was reason to believe it might not pass.
Yeah, certainly, it was definitely a bet at the time, I think.
Yeah, sir. I mean, like, we know now that it passed overwhelmingly, but at the time, we certainly thought, well, this is a third rail of San Diego politics, isn't it? You know, coastal development. And it's kind of a new understanding that maybe these things aren't as controversial as we had anticipated them to be. But at the time, they didn't know that. So now you've got all these developers who would be able to bid on the project knowing that there is no height limit in that area. And then also, you know, the city residents or the public will know that there will be at least 15% of those homes will be made available for people with low incomes. And then the other thing to watch that'll be interesting is the new mayor is not under any obligation to abide by the terms set by Mayor Faulkner when he put the project out for bid. And he really left that wide open. I mean, it was a pretty bare bones request for proposals. There weren't many requirements about what the developers were going to be forced to do. So Mayor Gloria could be more strict about that. He could take advantage of the fact that the height limit is now known to be increased and say, in exchange for bidding on this project, you must do X, Y, and Z and try to get more coming back to the city for it. We don't know that that'll happen yet, but it's a possibility.
One last thing we wanted to talk about. Last year, the city voted overwhelmingly to approve Measure B. That was a plan to create a new oversight commission for the San Diego Police Department. It was going to be a citizens oversight group. And in particular, it would have sort of two main assets. It would be able to A, subpoena officers and documents and say, like, come in and tell us what you did and why you did it. And B, it would have its own lawyer, right? It would have its own legal representative so it could, like, pursue these things with energy. Now, Andy, you tracked this week. There's some tension, some worries that the actual plan to implement it, so that the charter says you should create this, but now the city has to create the law for it and exactly how it will operate and, you know, fund it and make it happen. And so is that happening?
Yes, they released the ordinance this week, and it'll go to the city council's land use committee tomorrow. We're recording on Wednesday. That'll be tomorrow. And so we'll see how the city council handles it. Certainly the activist and advocacy community that had supported the measure is not happy with the ordinance that the city of San Diego has put out. That's the city that's been the city attorney's office, which has been working with Monica Montgomery Stepp's city council office kind of together. The advocacy community is not happy with the language as it exists today. Now, Monica Montgomery Stepp told me basically, if there are problems with the ordinance, that's what we're having open hearings for. If it needs to come back multiple times, we can do that. We're going to continue to have a very open community-centered process. So the opportunity for that is this week, and we'll see how much the city council goes forward with that. But, you know, interestingly, Monica Montgomery Stepp is not the only member of the city council on that committee. There are other people, and not all of them are as identified with criminal justice reform as she is. So it's not obvious necessarily that she'll be able to lead this process through to what she would want it to be.
It's also, I mean, of course she's right that this is the beginning of mm-hmm. the ordinance being heard before the council, and they have the power to make changes and, mm-hmm. and ask for more input. But it's not as if there hasn't been any input up to now. There right. have been many community forums, and the community has, you know, had a lot of opportunities to say what they wanted.
Right.
And so to get a draft that they believe doesn't include those things probably shapes their understanding of how much it will change now that it's in the council's hand, it's going through this formal process.
Yeah. And prior to seeing the ordinance, I was prepared for, like, really technical specific issues that these community members might have with the ordinance. And now that it's been released and they've been able to see it, there was a forum last night that San Diegans for Justice held. It really isn't that they're dissatisfied on, like, technical specifics. Pretty broadly, they have general concerns about the whole ordinance, the ordinance as a whole.
Yeah. Both the representation of the community, the people who are on the commission itself, and the powers that it will have once, you know, it takes shape.
Yeah. So I talked to Andrea St. Julian, who's a co-chair of San Diegans for Justice, who supported the measure. She said that there are three really big problems they have, and they are the three most important elements of Measure B that are problems with the way that the city has drawn up this ordinance. One is its definition of investigation, which they say would allow the commission to simply review an investigation that was conducted by internal affairs, which is how the previous board operated. And a big motivation of Measure B was so that they would conduct independent investigations. Yes. And so if it allows for this other non-independent investigation, that is a major weakness. The other thing she said is that it's a prescription for when subpoena power would be allowed is far too limited for what they had in mind. And then the other thing that she said was really important was that the commission would have its own independent legal counsel as opposed to the city attorneys. And the ordinance, she says, is silent on that matter. Mm-hmm. And so it's like the three biggest things that they thought made the creation of this new commission so influential are not adequately represented in the ordinance as it exists now.
Yeah, I was surprised in my initial spin through the ordinance by some of the provisions of who should be on the commission and how that's determined. You know, a lot of the community members who I've talked to have been pushing for some sort of weighted system where communities that experience more policing have a bigger presence on the commission. And right now it suggests sort of just like this, Each council district gets a member, and each neighborhood policing division gets a member, which they sort of closely mirror the council districts, but they're a little different geographically. But more or less, you know, like there'd be two people from Rancho Penasquitos and two people from Encanto, or, you know, it'd be roughly equal. And so that idea that it should be weighted is not reflected in the current ordinance. I also heard, you know, similarly that people who have experience in the criminal justice system, such as felons, people with criminal records, should be represented on the committee. And the committee, the language as it stands says, you know, everybody should get a criminal background check, and that a felony wouldn't preclude somebody from being a member. But the way it's written, it certainly doesn't encourage it in any way. It just says, look, you won't be, you know, prohibited from having this record, but you will have to submit to this criminal background check, which was kind of like a backwards view of it from what they seemed to be describing they wanted.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm eager to see not just how this plays out at the committee hearing this week, but as how it goes forward in the weeks ahead. I mean, you know, certainly I don't think anyone in elected office is more identified with the criminal justice reform movement than Councilwoman Monica Montgomery Stepp. And so she chairs that committee, and she certainly is positioned to have, frankly, as much influence as any one city council member can have on the situation. So we'll see how it goes.
All right, well, just a reminder, please send us the picture of what the surcharge is called on your restaurant bill. You can send that to Scott at voiceofsandiego.org, or send it to me on Twitter, VOSD Scott. That's VOSD Scott on Twitter. Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in the Voice of San Diego podcast studio for the first time in many, many months. It is the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in that studio for now. You can follow all of our investigations and updates on local news with The Morning Report, our most popular newsletter. Find it in 9 other newsletters we produce. 9? Really? What do we do? At Voice of San Diego, VOSD.org/newsletters. That's VOSD.org/newsletters. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego. Andrew Keats is Assistant Editor. Sarah Libby's Managing Editor. And this show was produced in the Voice of San Diego podcast studio expertly by Nate John. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week. Dude!